Kingdom has ruled that the fatal shooting of an unarmed black man by London police was lawful. Mark Duggan's 2011 death at the hands of law enforcement sparked nationwide rioting and looting. The unrest, the worst in decades, killed 5 people and caused hundreds of millions of euros in property damage. The scene outside the courthouse on Wednesday was chaotic, with supporters of the Duggan family shouting, "No justice, no peace." Carol Duggan, Mark's aunt, said her nephew had been executed.
He was executed, and we still believe that, and we're going to fight until we have no breath in our body for justice, for Mark, for his children, and for all of those of the deaths in custody.
London police claimed that at the time of the shooting, they believed Mark was carrying an illegal handgun, but no handgun was found on his person. Police said Mark Duggan, unbeknown to them, had ditched the gun just moments before fleeing a taxi cab. Duggan was a suspected gang member.
The Turkish government has said
you are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
Everett Leroy Jones. That was my grandfather's name was Everett. He was a politician in that town. My family came to Newark in the 20s. We've been there a long, long time. My father's name was Leroy. You know, the Frenchified aspect of it, because his first name was Coyette. You see, they come from South Carolina. You see, I changed my name when we became aware of the African Revolution and the whole question of our African roots. I was named by the man who buried Malcolm X, Hisham Jabir, who died last week. He named me Amir Barakat, but that's Arabic. I brought it down into Swahili land, into Tanzania, which is an accent. So it's Amiri instead of Amir, and, you know, Baraka rather than Barakat, you know, which is interesting. If it was Amir Barakat, I'd probably have more difficulty flying.
Angry Indian Radio. You are listening to the Angry Indian Unintelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Listening to the Angry Indian Unintelligent Aboriginal Radio. Real talk for the fourth world.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Who are you? You don't know. Don't tell me Negro, that's nothing. What were you before the white man named you a Negro? And where were you? And what did you have? What was yours? And how did he take it? What gun did you see? Where is your history? How did the man wipe out your history? How did the man, what did the man do to make you as dumb as you are right now?
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
All Indians all over the land, all saying the same thing. This is our homeland. This is our birthright. They don't want any white man comes in here and tell us that you have to divide this up this way or that way. The white man doesn't own this land. Just because he has a gun, he said, I took your land.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Transmitting from within the occupied Aboriginal territories of North America to the people of the Fourth World and all ships at sea. This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Internet radio for smart aboriginal.
Este es Aborigen Inteligente de Radio. This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Why is we Americans? Budida. 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 Big dee 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 boo boo boo. What I want is me, for real. I want me and myself, and what that is what I be and what I see and feel, and who is me and the what it is and who it is and when it me is what it be. I'm gonna be here if I want, like I said, self-determination. But I ain't come from a foolish tribe. We wants the mule, the land. You can make it 300 years of blue chip stock in the entire operation. We want to be paid in a central bank, the average worker, farmer wage for all those years we gave it free. Plus, we want damages for all the killings and the fraud, the lynchings, the missing justice, the lies and frame-ups, the unwarranted jailings, the tar and featherings, the character and race assassinations, historical slander, ugly caricatures. For every Sambo, step and fetch it flick, we want to be paid. For every hurtful thing you did or said, for all the land you took, for all the rapes, all the rosewoods and black Wall Street you destroyed, all the miseducation, jobs lost, segregated shacks we lived in, the disease that ate and killed us, for all the mad police that drilled us, for all the music and dances you stole, the styles, the language, the hip clothes you copped, the careers you stopped. All these are suits, specific litigation as represent we, be like we, for reparations for damages paid to the Afro-American nation. Budida, budida, budida. We want education for all of us and anyone else in the black belt hurt by slavery, for all the native peoples, even them poor white people you show all the time is funny, all them Abners and Daisy Mays, them Beverly Hillbillies who never got to know Beverly Hills, who never got to Harvard on their grandfather's wheels. We want reparations for them, right on, for the Mexicans whose land you stole, for all of North Mexico, you call it Texas, Arizona, California, New Mexico, Colorado, all that, all that, all that, all that. Be-dee-da, doo-doo, bap, 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 bap. All that you got to give up. Autonomy and reparations to the Chicanos and the Native Americans whose soul you ripped out with their land. Give self-determination, regional autonomy. That's what my we is asking, and they're going to do the same when they demand it like us again in their own exploited name. Yeah, the education, that's right. 200 years. We want a central stash, a central bank with democratically elected trustees and a board elected by us all to map out from the referendum we set up what we want to spend it on to build that Malcolm sense self-determination as self-reliance and self-respect and self-defense, the will of what the good Dr. Du Bois beat on, true self-consciousness, simply the psychology of freedom. Budida, 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 that ba ba ba, budi budi boo boo boo. Then we can talk about being American. Then we can listen. Then we can listen without the undercurrent of desire to first set your on fire. We will only talk of voluntary unity of autonomy as vective arms of self-determination if there is democracy in you. That is where it will be shown. This is the only way we as Americans. This is the only truth that can be told. Otherwise, there is no future between us but war, and we as rather lovers and singers and dancers and poets and drummers and actors and runners and elegant heartbeats of the sun's flame. But we as also at the end of our silence and sit down. We as at the end of being under your ignorant smell, your intentional hell. Either give us our lives or plan to forfeit your own.
Este es aborigen inteligente de radio, 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 radio.
Internet radio for smarter originals.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Transmitting to the people of the fourth world from within occupied North America. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Salutan and peace to all original human beings resident on the physical plane. I'm your host, Angry Indian. Editor-in-Chief of the Aboriginal Press News Service, logging to the fourth world from aboriginalnewswire.tumblr.com and aboriginalpress.wordpress.com and ang-newswire.blogspot.com. Thank you for tuning in to Indigenous News, Thought, and Analyses concerning the issues that matter to original peoples and other communities across the world living under imperial, theological, racist, neoclassist, neocolonialist, neoliteral, neoliberal, neofascist, and neo-misogynist control. I wish to welcome you all to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome along, welcome along. I wish peace to the gods and earths and love and solidarity to the entire original family in this time of strife and struggle. I'm your host, the Angry Indian, and I'm here, as always, with my co-executive producer and studio engineer, Ms. Guadalupe Morales. And we'd like to wish all of our listeners and all of our compadres, all of our comrades, a safe Gregorian White Man's Calendar 2014, because 2013 was pretty fucked up. I mean, you know, let's just be straight about it. 2013 was the year of coonery. You know, it was a year of African coonery. It was a year of white Negro coonery. It was a year of Native coonery. It was a year of Asian coonery. You know, it was a year of, you know, just, you know, complete bullshit. I don't know how to look at it. You know, bullshit from the from government. You know, pick a country. You know, bullshit in the public sphere. You know, bullshit on the internet. Bullshit in journalism. You know, complete lies and falsehoods and double truths and nonsense and smoke and mirrors and cloak and dagger. From, you know, all of the information centers. And we're surrounded by information centers. I mean, they now know what you're typing, even if you're not connected to the internet. They know what you're thinking. You know, I mean, this is beyond knowing what porn you look at, you know. And whatever alter egos you might have on the internet and what have you. This is, you know, everything that the Stasi wished that they had, that the U.S. State Department and a bunch of other people like Joe McCarthy, you know, pick any of the Bushes, right? Bush the Elder, Bush the Younger, you know, any of the other little minions that, you know, running about there in Kennebunkport or whatever they got going on down there in Texas. You know, this is all of the propaganda, the anti-Mao propaganda, right? The anti-Leninist propaganda. Right? Not to say that Lenin and Mao were, what's the word, Lupe? Were they perfect beings? Absolutely not. And anyone who says anything like that is a nutcase. You know, I mean, it's completely, you know, wrong-headed, and it's completely due to propaganda that whenever people, especially in the West, and especially in the United States and Canada, you know, and Mexico for that matter. You know, whenever you hear communism, you know, it begins and ends, you know, with Stalin. And that's it. You know, which is pretty funny because Stalin was the link. You know, if there was a link. You know, we keep hearing a lot about a friendship pact. This really wasn't a friendship pact. It was a non-aggression pact. You know, if you keep listening to Glenn Beck, you know, like this other idiot they just got recently for a series of incidences. You know, he had to be listening to Glenn Beck. You know, or, like, remember the Tides Foundation, that fool they called on his way to go do damage to that? You know, they listened to Glenn Beck. They listened to Bill O'Reilly. They listened to Sean Hannity. They listened to Brian Fisher. They listened to Klingon Smith, who really needs to come out of the fucking closet, you know, and I know gay people don't want to claim him or many of these other Republicans and preachers and priests and cardinals. And, you know, I don't know what's going on with Pope Benedict. You know, is he not? I don't know. You know, is he going to continue to allow these cover-ups? I would really hope the fuck not. But he's definitely going after the money, isn't he? You know, I mean, what's pretty funny is that the most promising thing about 2013 was Pope fucking Benedict. You know, which is pretty fucked up being that he represents the Catholic Church. I'm talking about fucked up in terms of what the institution represents historically, what the institution represents politically, and what the institution represents in terms of human rights. You know, I mean, you know, you can make all the fucking jokes you want about the predatory priest, but, you know, think in terms of what happened to Bishop, was it Archbishop, right? Lupe Moreno. You know, what the hell happened with that? What the hell happened with that? You know, he speaks up for the people, for the indigenous people there in South America, and what happened to him while he was giving a service. You know, because you talk to most Catholics, you know, they talk about Padre Pio all day long, which I'm not saying anything negative about him. You know, I don't know if I necessarily buy the whole stigmata thing, but, you know, okay, fine. They remember him, right? And they want to talk about the miracles at Lourdes, which we know there are no goddamn miracles there. That's a whole lot of nonsense. And it's driven by faith. And we all know faith is steadfast. I want to believe in something, even though there's absolutely no logical reason for me to hold on to it. You know, which has a lot to do with the political problems that I'm discussing. And the social issues that I'm discussing. And a type of society that we've developed where if we just keep adding on more labels, if we just keep adding on more confusion to things, if we make things more and more complicated, that somehow this is going to work out. That if we add more and more laws, that if you get more and more mercenaries, that if there's, you know, more and more conflict and more and more control, that everything now is going to fit into a tiny, perfect little box. And that's simply not going to happen. It's not going to happen the way you want it to. You know, and see, this is the thing I've been trying to say to a lot of these pork chop nationalists. And you know who I'm talking about. You know, I mean, I'm down with wearing dashikis and everything, man. And I'm totally cool with dreadlocks. But when you start using that as a bludgeon against people. And I'm not talking about people who are necessarily, however you want to look at it. I mean, some of you have used the real, I think, you know, really harsh language. Saying that a brother or sister is counterproductive simply because they have, straightened hair, or simply because a brother or sister is homosexual, what have you. That's on his face, that's ridiculous. Where did their politics lie? See, ask that question. Now, I'm not at all cool with the whole hair processing thing because, you know, a week or so ago, or maybe a couple of weeks ago, maybe a fortnight ago, you know, there was noise online about Madam C.J. Walker, because we all know, first female millionaire in the United States, you know, self-made, right? You know, black woman, self-made millionaire, first woman to gain that kind of financial status. But how did she gain that financial status? She gained that financial status by teaching black women to basically, you know, try to mask their own identity. Because she said in the ads, I've seen them. There's a book that you can find in most of the more progressive African-centered bookstores in the bookshops in the United States. It's called The Black Book. It was produced in the 70s. I believe it was 1976. I used to have a copy. I haven't seen one in a long time. But they had some of those original ads from the black newspapers at the time. And I know a lot of you don't know this, but there used to be a real African-centered press in the United States. Same thing with, you know, Greek language, Russian language. Anyone from a major city on the East Coast knows this. Of a certain age, remembers this. But for young people now, I mean, there's not one goddamn piece of entertainment. Well, actually, let me not say that, because all Negroes are about is entertainment, right? But, you know, maybe you haven't seen the news recently. It was on the Pew Research Center and Media Matters. You know, the white news outlets picked it up, that there is not one local independent television station any longer, or radio station for that matter, that is owned by an African in the United States, which means that all of the media is owned by somebody else. So everything that you watch, be it from BlackPlanet.com, is that even still up? BlackPlanet.com, is that even still up? You know, BlackPlanet.com, BET, you know, all of that, none of that is owned or controlled by people of color. But, you know, and I hate to say this, but I'm going to point it out, because, you know, this is what it is. You assimilationist Negroes, who are all elated now because two females were just brought onto the writing staff of Saturday Night Live. Explain to me how that's progress. You know, it's the same thing with this whole Beyonce. This is what I'm talking about with 2013. You know, the same thing with Beyonce. You know, I'm really tired of people, you know, trying to make these, you know, intellectual arguments. They think they're intellectual arguments anyway. I suppose if you use a lot of big words and you bring up concepts that seem like they fit, it sounds important. You know what I'm talking about. On why the blonde and skin-bleached Beyonce is somehow the new face of black feminism, and how her blonde and bleached skin is pushing the white feminists to the side. What the hell are we talking about? I mean, you know, I just found out before we came on today, and, you know, rest in peace, Brother Amiri Baraka. You know, we've had our disagreements with the brother, but, you know, at least he was always down with the program, you know. But, you know, there have been various times that, you know, he was not as progressive politically as I thought he would be. But he was certainly way more progressive, way more expressive, way more artistic, way more intelligent, and way more, you know, wise than the coonery that I'm talking about right now, to where Beyonce somehow represents black womanhood. She doesn't. No more than her husband, Jay-Z, represents the black man anywhere in the diaspora. Anyone who says that his presence is charity is crazy. I told you, you know, a retired pimp I know said he never even had the audacity to say that to any of his women when he was, you know, at the top of his game. You know, it was just complete nonsense for Jay-Z to come out and say something like that. And then that beef he got into with Harry Belafonte, I mean, come on, man. And then Obama taking selfies at the goddamn funeral for Nelson Mandela. Come on. 2013 was the year of coonery. It was the year of bullshit. We got in more wrapped up into conversations about Miley Cyrus and what the fuck was his name? The Canadian Cat's kid. You know, the cat with the perfect hair. I can't remember his name. Who gives the fuck? But you know who I'm talking about. The other performer. You know, she's grinding on him. You know, it's like, what the hell is this? But they're surrounded by black and brown people to make all of the white Negro coonery. And I'm saying this in quotes now. Look legit. You know, I mean, Norman Mailer wrote about this a long fucking time ago. You know, people who wrote about the muds in the 60s in England, especially in London and Manchester, have talked about this, the white Negro. Pete Townsend from The Who. I mean, come on. You know, he was very clear about this, that they were white kids in England who were copying what they saw, what they felt, what was hip about black people. You know, I mean, there are interviews on film with the homie from the Rolling Stones, Mick Jagger, saying the same thing, that the only music that was worth anything was black music. John Lennon from the Beatles said the same thing. Ringo Starr said the same thing. And, you know, they were all chastised in the American press for this. At one point, they were burning their records. And it wasn't just because of what John Lennon said about the Bible, which was true, which was factually true, you know. They didn't like them because they were playing nigger music down. I mean, that was the whole point about the South. We're talking about the Mississippi Sovereignty Commission. Why would they want to have a bunch of white Englishmen coming down there playing black music, enticing their young people? Hell no, man. I mean, you know, they were using that type of racism as one of the reasons to go after marijuana. You know, depending on where you were in the country, right? If you were in Texas, you were in Arizona, New Mexico, what have you, California, Louisiana, and if you were Mexicano and you had marijuana on you, right? If you had Mota on your person, or they knew that you were dealing it in particular, well, yeah, you got hit. And then when they asked, and then when they, you know, when they got you, they were less like, hey, you know, we got to get this scourge of these goddamn Mexicans bringing up this devil weed. That's what they were calling it, right? What was his name? Jay Anslinger. The cat that they put in charge, they made all of this, you know, shit illegal in the first place, right? You know, a fucking leaf, right? So then here we go. When it comes to African folks, and what happens? You know, the rumor was, and it was a strong rumor because people seem to believe this shit, that if, you know, white people start smoking marijuana, that they'll listen to jazz music and have sex with black people. in particular black men. And when they said that, depending on who you talk to, they said they meant men and women. That, you know, if you're a white male and you smoke marijuana, you will listen to jazz, turn around, drop your trousers, and give it up to any strong black male that asked you for some. So, you know, this was the type of fear and misinformation and total nonsense that was going about based on what? Based on what? So, you know, instead of looking at how these things got started and how they relate to what's happening today, and I'm not saying that this whole Miley Cyrus thing is not an issue. And I'm not saying it shouldn't be dissected and deconstructed and analyzed. And then, if necessary, thrown back into the faces of white people, philosophically and politically, you know, when appropriate. But see, the thing is, that's not what's happening. See, we're talking about Kanye West being a fucking genius. I know I'm being redundant, but Kanye West being a fucking genius, you know, because he's taking the Confederate flag and doing what with it? He comes out with an album, Black Skinhead, identifying what? Identifying the, what, you know, what, man? Yeah, there's such a thing as black skinheads. I mean, that's what it actually started with. Jamaican immigrants in the UK. And these are white guys who were copying what the fuck they were doing. They were copying their dress and they were copying their music. Because anybody who knows anything at all about Jamaican music knows that when ska got to England, it became pretty much a white boy's thing. Not to say the black people didn't, you know, stop listening to it, but that was the whole point. The whole point of, what was it, the Specials, the Selector, all of the ska bands, you know, they were supposedly two-tone bands. They were black and white bands. These were white kids. Yeah, pretty much the same analogy today if you see a white, you know, rapper. And I'm going to be straight up with you, man. You know, in my own mind, man, in my own philosophy, it's kind of hard for me to look at most white rappers and take them seriously. It's very difficult for me, politically speaking. You know, I mean, it took me a lot just to get over that, you know, whole thing with jazz. But see, the thing about jazz is, though, you know, white people who were into jazz back in the 50s, back in the 60s, even up to the 70s, they understood politically what they were dealing with. See, nowadays, you know, white guys, you know, white cats get into hip hop, rap, whatever the fuck you want to call it, because it's all commercial, mainstream, marginalized, you know, it's all mainstream motherfucking entertainment for me. It's amusement, you know, it's amusement. It's, you know, a means in which to take you away from really thinking about any goddamn thing. Yeah, I know, hip hop is the CNN of the ghetto. Yeah, I know, I know, I know. I've heard all that already. But, you know, it doesn't really present any fucking thing other than say, yeah, people out here going through a rough time. That's it. Sorry. You can't build a movement on that. All right. You cannot build a movement on hip hop. You know, Jim Hall in San Francisco. I know you don't like to hear me say this. I'm sorry about that. But you cannot build a movement based on rap. You couldn't build a movement based on jazz. I know people who saw the musical Serafina thought that that was what ended apartheid. No. That's like saying the butler made you free. Get fucking real. And this is my point. You're looking at all of these goddamn entertainers. You're looking at the mainstream media. And you feel that unless you keep up with this, that somehow you're behind. That somehow you're left out. So you have straight folks who instead of really trying to live their, you have gay people who instead of just trying to live their fucking lives and demanding, you know, fair play when they go for services, when it comes to their civil and political and human rights. See, I will always stand by that. And, you know, it's probably about time that, you know, we start adding, you know, neo-homophobic to the already long goddamn list of things that we stand against at the beginning of the shows. But, you know, I mean, I suppose it's past time for that. But see, the thing is, though, to me, your sexuality really is your fucking business. Now, as I've tried to explain to a lot of straight folks, the only reason you even have a gay movement is because so many fucking straight people, usually because of their bullshit you know, well, the excuse is religion, but usually it's just goddamn fear and hatred because their religion tells them the shit is wrong. So everybody gets to deal with the fucking, you know, worrying about that thing, or the hammer comes down on them. And in the meantime, they still want to do what the fuck they want to do, right? But they feel bad about it. So when they see somebody that's out, or someone who really can't conceal what the fuck is going on, it's just animosity. They just hate on them. So, you know, taking out your aggressions, right, your frustrations on an object or an element that actually has nothing personal to do with you. But, you know, well, ask yourselves. I mean, Hitler was gay, and what did he do? He did everything he possibly could to wipe out as many gay people as possible. He started with Ernst Röhm, and then he worked his fucking way down. You know, he worked his way down. Do you think this Albert Speer and the rest of them did not know that, you know, Adolf liked men? Clearly it was known in Berlin at the time, in all of the major cities, that Adolf Hitler was, you know, a man's man, right? But what did he do? Same thing when we look at J. Edgar Hoover. Now, how he and Clyde Tolson got together, I have absolutely no fucking idea. I know they stayed together, the fuck together for life. You know, they had a secret marriage. In the meantime, he was harming everybody else's goddamn life, right? People who weren't even necessarily homosexual, you know, just to get them out of the way, because this was the attitude of the time. But why was the attitude like this? Look at the society that produced it. Because, you know, Europeans came here with this really fucked up and closed-minded and stupid anti-human goddamn attitude. But indigenous people didn't have that attitude. Not in North America. Indigenous people in Asia didn't have it either. Matter of fact, people in South America didn't have this goddamn problem. It seems that only Europeans have this motherfucking problem. Now, why am I saying this? Why am I even talking about this? Well, see, one of the coonery aspects of 2013 was the support that I'm seeing amongst people who should fucking know better, be they political or not. There's people who should goddamn know better. Who should know fucking better? Who are okay with Uganda passing this anti-fucking gay law? First off, they never read the law. They didn't even know what it was about. And they were already supportive of it. And then for some reason, they don't believe that there was homosexuality in Africa. They somehow believe that homosexuality came into Africa with white people, with colonialism, with European colonialism, which is complete bullshit. Anybody that understands Vodun or any of the other indigenous religions already motherfucking knows what the hell is going on with that. So we already know that that's complete bollocks. Bullshit. Nonsense. You know, it's like that type of, that Karenga type shit, you know. I really have no time for that, man. Like I said, I'm down with the shikis. I'm down with the dreadlocks. I'm down with natural hair. I'm down with the afro and shit, you know. But this whole thing, man, about, you know, homosexuality is not, you know, it didn't exist. And, you know, it's just, look, I will always make the argument that it is normal in terms of how people get along with each other. Homosexuality, bisexuality, those are the only two terms, you know, I choose to recognize. This intersexed and cis and non-cis, you know, you're really driving me motherfucking crazy with all of this shit. You're making things unnecessarily goddamn complicated. So you had, you know, angry gay people calling straight people breeders, but now you can't even say straight people, right? Because that's bad English now. So you have to say cis male or cis female, which is, you know, fucking ridiculous. And, you know, and I'm sorry, gay folks, and if you don't like this and don't want to tune in anymore, I'll understand. But you know what? You're doing what everything else is doing in the society. You're making things ridiculously fucking complicated. And for you people of color that are following this, I think you're fucking crazy. You're not even asking yourself how the hell you really fit into this shit. You're following whatever the fuck white people are doing. And all they're doing is confusing their fucking selves. You know, for those of us who remember the Salem Institute, and I'm not saying that I've ever been there, or the Transcendental Meditation, or the any of those crazy goddamn fads that went on during the 60s and 70s and some up into the fucking 80s. Where are they now? They're fucking nowhere. Even this whole queer thing, I've said it before and I say it again, I think you're motherfucking being ridiculous by calling yourselves queer. It's the same shit with nigger. You know, which, and I told you, I was at those goddamn meetings on the fucking East Coast when this argument was being debated. Right? You had Michelangelo Signorelli. Is that how you pronounce his name? He's a DJ now on Sirius, but he used to be a... well, he's still a journalist, I suppose. I don't really follow his work anymore. But he used to write for the gay media on the East Coast. And he started the whole outing thing. And I don't know if it was he that actually came up with the idea queer, or it was popularized in many of his articles or editorials or what have you. But in any case, I was at a lot of these meetings. And, you know, people would say, well, we want to be identified as queer, not LGBT, you know, very young people. And they said it. Well, black people are calling themselves nigger to take the sting out of the word. So we demand to be called queer to take the sting out of that word. And, you know, my question is this. Black men have been calling themselves nigger here out in the open in front of white people in total earshot of all the bigots that surround us. Like a fly amongst the buttermilk, right? Just stand out there calling yourself a nigger. Hey, you know, that's been going on for a long time now. Almost 20 motherfucking years. At this point, right? Almost 20 years. Has it helped? Every 28 hours, there's somebody, you know, a black man or woman who is being removed from this planet by a police officer, a security guard, or somebody like George Zimmerman. One of these goddamn random vigilantes. Now, they will take anti-Zimmerman artwork off of eBay, but Zimmerman can sell his artwork on eBay so he can pay his legal fees. Yeah, figure that one out. It's like when, you know, WikiLeaks, you can't give them money, but you can give money to the Klan, right? Let that trickle down for a little bit. Now, I know I'm jumping around here, but, you know, that's how 2013 was. We jumped around all over the goddamn place with absolutely no motherfucking plan, thinking that the ACA, otherwise known as the Affordable Care Act, which isn't really making anything affordable for a handful of people. A lot of other folks are losing their fucking insurance. People I know. Or the insurance is being jacked up to where they can't afford it. They don't know what the hell they're going to do. Right? But see, what do you expect? The ACA, otherwise known as Obamacare, which is a misnomer, the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, was written by the Heritage Foundation. Don't believe me? Look it up. The GOP wrote that. And then the Obama administration, which never goes against the goddamn GOP and never goes against Israel, ever. You know, that program they got going on in Tel Aviv, where they just gave them, what, damn near $600 million again. You know, they're broke here. They don't have any money for anything here, but they got enough money to give them to, what, hold everything down in occupied Palestine. I mean, I assume that's what's going on. Like I said, the year of complete bullshit. But yeah, you know, this whole cis thing. I mean, look, I understand, you know, trans people, gay people, what have you. Like I said, we just had Sophia Banks on. You know, that's not to say that, oh, well, doesn't mean that I'm not homophobic. Look, I'm not goddamn homophobic. But, you know, you got to, you know, really stop it with these fucking terms. If somebody's living as a particular gender, just fucking go ahead and accept that. You know, I mean, I believe that's what the majority of them want, at least the people that I know anyway. Now, yeah, we all know that there's psycho, you know, trannies. Or can you even use that word anymore? I guess not, right? Okay. We have what used to be called the psycho trannies, right? You know, I mean, they fully going out for shock. You know, it's not intended to really be about anything other than shock. They say they're making an artistic and political and historical statements like Genesis P. Orridge or what have you. And, you know, maybe. Or even David Shiler. For those of you who have been following the 911, I don't even know what the hell to call that. Because we know that, if you know anything at all about the original, the official story, there's no way you can believe the official story. It's the same thing with the Kennedy assassination. We just went through that a couple of months ago, right? You know, if you know the official story, if you've read the Warren Report, and I have, there's no way you can believe the Warren Report. You know, all inspectors, all kinds of, pseudo science is not science. And Ford, well, look, he became president. Spector became, a senator. You know, just about everybody that was involved in that, you know, it got into high office someplace else. And, you know, in terms of Justice Warren, I don't know what the hell, I don't know what he was thinking. I don't know what kind of pressure they put on him. It goes beyond Oswald being set up and Ruby and what have you. But like I said, you know, this will happen. Iran-Contra will happen. Watergate will happen. The church committee, Pike committees will happen, right? We'll find all this malfeasance. The Danziger Bridge, right? In New Orleans. You know, all of these things will happen. Bush being caught on film. You know, what's the point of having all this goddamn surveillance if you have George W. Bush II speaking to the head of FEMA, talking about, yeah, Brian, we got you covered in terms of the Katrina catastrophe. And, you know, he wasn't held accountable for none of it. How about those put options that Dick Cheney put up, you know, about, you know, what could possibly happen? Everybody just forgot about that, right? So, yeah, you know, 2013 wasn't about anything but utter confusion, total fucking stupidity, and, you know, capitalist malfeasance. But, hey, man, you know, it seems to be the world that you all want because you're letting this develop. You dig what I'm saying? You know, so all the talk about, you know, human rights, all the talk about democracy and all of that, you know, it's a whole lot of talk. Because from where I'm sitting, it doesn't seem like 2014 is going to be any different than 13. This is the Angry Indian. Please stay tuned.
Hi, this is Zesh9 from Zesh9.com. And you're listening to the Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Don't let the colonial occupation blues get you down. Listen to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. The podcast for Intelligent Aboriginals.
Hello, I am Susan Aglukkaq. The North has the highest incidence of sexually transmitted disease, STDs, in the country. We also have a high rate of teenage pregnancies. High-risk behaviors, unprotected sex, lead to the spread of HIV/AIDS. It can be prevented. Learn the ways to protect yourself and others. Knowledge is power.
Radio Insurgente, la voz de los sin voz.
Vamos, 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 vamos adelante, para que salgamos en la lucha avante, porque nuestra patria grita y necesita de todo el esfuerzo de los zapatistas.
Transmitiendo desde algún lugar de las montañas del sureste mexicano, en la frecuencia 100.1 en FM.
I'm Dick Gregory with PETA. Martin Luther King Jr. taught me the fight against oppression is never an easy one. It's even harder if you have no voice. For animals held captive in circuses, life consists of cramped cages, shackles, and daily beatings. There is no escape. They cannot demand their freedom. Images like these bring only one word to my mind, slavery. Be an abolitionist for the animals. Please don't go to circuses. For more information, contact PETA.
757-622-PETA.
Palestine is one of the most reported places in the world.
But there's still a lot of misinformation about the reality on the ground.
What much of the media fails to explain
is that since 1948, nearly 75% of the entire indigenous Palestinian population
have been forcibly driven off our land
to make room for the creation of the so-called State of Israel.
And we are denied the right to return to our homeland.
The remaining 25% of Palestinians live as second-class citizens in the State of Israel, all under a brutal military occupation in the West Bank and Gaza Strip.
While world powers fund and support Israel,
we,
the people of the world in our millions,
support the Palestinian people's struggle for freedom and equal rights.
If I boycott Israeli goods,
it's because I oppose an illegal occupation.
Because I oppose racism. Because I oppose brutality towards the indigenous people of a land. reject the notion that I am anti-Semitic.
I reject the notion I'm a self-hating Jew, simply because I oppose the idea of an exclusively Jewish state.
There is only one line of division.
It's not a line of division between Muslims and Jews.
It's not a line of division between Palestinians and Israelis.
It is a line of division.
It is a line of division.
It is a line of division between those who stand for the equality of all
and those who stand for the supremacy of some. Boycott apartheid.
Boycott Israel. Boycott apartheid.
Boycott Israel.
Boycott apartheid. Boycott Israel.
Now that America has a black president, is this proof that racism is a thing of the past?
Well, I think white men were 100% of the people that wrote the Constitution, 100% of the people who signed the Declaration of Independence, 100% of the people who died at Gettysburg and Vicksburg, probably close to 100% of the people who died at Normandy. This has been a country built basically by white folks in this country who were 90% of the entire nation. I think they ought to defend the legitimate rights of white working class folks who are the victims of discrimination.
With white people showing love like this, who needs enemies? Intelligent Aboriginal Media. The anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.
This is Radio Anglo-Indian. Anglo-Indian Radio for the Fourth World.
Born in Newark, where he continues to live. He has distinguished himself in a number of areas as a writer of poetry and plays, including The Dutchman and The Slave, and books like Blues People. As a political activist, his involvements are too numerous to fully itemize here, but they do include presiding over the National Black Political Convention in Gary, Indiana, the Committee for a Unified Newark, and the Congress of African People. In academia, he studied at Rutgers and Howard Universities and has had affiliations with Columbia University, Yale, the University of Buffalo, and the New School of Social Research. Here's an example of the artistic and political fire that Mr. Baraka possesses, his eulogy at the funeral of James Baldwin.
The family would like to acknowledge the international outpouring of feeling for Jimmy Baldwin, the kindness of people. I also bring the love and greetings not only of black artists in Newark, but all over the world. Jimmy, we know, or ought to know by now, that what we call reality exists independent of any of the multi-vision subjectivisms that nevertheless distort and actually parallel life here. For me, one clear example of the dichotomy between what actually is and what might be reflected in some smeared mirror of private need is the public characterization of the mighty being for whom we are gathered here to bid our tearful farewells. You will notice happily, or with whatever degree of predictable social confusion, that I have spoken of Jimmy. And it is he, this Jimmy of whom I will continue to speak, it is this Jimmy, this glorious, elegant griot of our oppressed African-American nation who I am eulogizing. So let the butchering copy editors of our captivity stay for an eternal moment their dead eraser fingers from our celebration. There will be and should be reams and reams of analysis, even praise for our friend, but also even larger measures of non-analysis and certainly condemnation for James Baldwin, the Negro writer. Alas, we have not yet the power to render completely sterile or make impossible the errors and lies which will merely be America being itself rather than its unconvincing promise. But the wide gap, the world-spanning abyss between the James Baldwin of yellow journalism and English departments, and here we thought this was America, and the Jimmy Baldwin of our real lives is stunning. When he told us nobody knows my, he meant our name. He was trying to get you ready for it even then. For one thing, no matter the piles of deathly prose, citing influences, relationships, metaphor, and criticisms that will attempt to tell us about our older brother, most will miss the mark simply because for the most part they will be retelling old lies or making up new ones or shaping yet another black life to fit the great white stomach which yet rules and tries to digest the world. For first of all, Jimmy Baldwin was not only a writer, an international literary figure, he was a man, spirit, voice, old and black and terrible as that first ancestor. As a man, he came to us from the family, the human lives, names we can call David, Gloria, Lover, George, Sam, Barbara, Ruth, Elizabeth, Paula. And this extension is one intimate identification as he could so casually in that way of his eyes and self-smiling, not much larger than that first ancestor, fragile as truth always is. Big eyes popped out like righteous monitors of the soulful. The Africans say that big old eyes like that means someone can make things happen. And didn't he? Between Jimmy's smile and grace, his insistent elegance, even as he damned you, even as he smote what evil was unfortunate, breathing or otherwise, to stumble his way, he was all the way live, all the way conscious, turn all the way up, receiving and broadcasting, sometimes so hard what needed to would back up from those two television tubes poking out of his head. As man, he was my friend, my older brother, he would joke, not really joking. As man, he was our friend, our older, our younger brother. We listened to him like we would somebody in our family. Whatever you might think of what he might say, we could hear it. He was close as man, as human relative. We could make it some cold seasons, merely warmed by his handshake, smile or eyes. Warmed by his voice, jocular, yet instantly cutting, kind, yet perfectly clear. We could make it sometimes just remembering his arm waved in confirmation or indignation, the rapid fire speech pushing out at the world like urgent messages for those who would be real.
Mr. Baraka is our sole guest in this edition. We'll get underway in a moment.
This is you.
That clip that we showed with you eulogizing James Baldwin, have you recovered, and has the artistic community recovered from that loss?
Not really. I think that that's something that has to be sort of synthesized into something else. I mean, certainly one finally does understand what the old folks were talking about spirits and the spirit, because James Baldwin's spirit is going to be here, you know, as long as there's somebody to recognize it. Do you understand what I mean? Because all I have to do is say, Jimmy, be back. You know, like you say about Malcolm, you know, you say, Malcolm X, and he's on the scene. You know, I mean, that spirit is there. But the point is, in terms of making a coherent use of what he produced for us, that takes time. I just did a paper at the National Black Arts Conference on James Baldwin called The Blood of the Lamb, talking about what was his real religion. What kind of religious understanding did he have? Was there a spiritual reference to his work? And I think it was, and obviously it was. Charting it and analyzing it was a lot of fun too. You know, doing it.
Did he have an impact on your writing? And if so, in what specific way, as you can discern?
Well, Jimmy was, the thing about Jimmy is that he created modern American speech. People are not hip to that because they're not hip to what they're saying. You know, see, Baldwin represented the kind of incisive intellectual who was able to analyze and identify phenomena while in motion. You understand what I'm saying? You ever see somebody walk into a room and say, you know, oh, hello, 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 you know, like Jimmy would do, taking off his coat? Well, that was his method of analyzing everything. He was actually talking. He wasn't writing. You understand what I mean? The writing was sort of like a, making a script out of what he was saying, what he was observing. See, so that was the living element of his speech. His speech was fully live, you see. And that was the thing we always liked, or at least I always liked, because Baldwin always talked like somebody you were talking to. It wasn't like a dry text. You know, it was like somebody saying, yeah, well, how are you? you know, I mean, where have you been? And I'll tell you what I saw, and this happened. Especially if you look at that book called, you know, what is it called? Remembrances or Evidence of Things Not Seen.
Yeah,
the thing about Atlanta. But that's back of a book. But that's written like it's almost a conversation with two or three people. But I mean, it's not in that, say, form, but in terms of the motion, you know, the kind of thrust of the language, the kind of address that he uses, you know. And
did that filter into your style?
Well, for the last thing, I tried to very much in that eulogy, I tried to write something like Jamil for that reason. I mean, I was actually trying to get that, you know, that what I liked about him. See, that to me, that was the form of remembering him, is to try to get what I thought. You know, I did that with Zora Neale Hurston and Langston. I had a conversation. I wrote a conversation between the two of them. You know, what that would have sounded like. You know what I mean? Because that's a funny group right there, you know? So to really sort of raise Jimmy's speech, you know, which was so exquisite, you know, so precise. That's what I was trying to capture, that almost so he would be eulogizing himself, you know. But
what kind of discipline do you impose on yourself as a writer? And is it different from poetry as opposed to writing a play, as opposed to writing a book?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Poetry is just the work of the heart straight out. I mean, you can be doing anything, and the poem comes and says, okay, slap. You're going to write it. But a lot of things, you know, you have to sort of pump yourself up to go from point one to point B, you know, like that. But I think it's like everything else, you know, when people are saying, in the basketball court, well, he missed that because he was aiming. That's usually what it is. Writers are, I think, let's say, skilled writers have the capacity to absorb, you know, phenomena in detail in living situations. You don't have to do this. You know, somebody said, you know, I'm writing Max Roach's autobiography now, and a guy asked me about a tape recorder. I use a tape recorder if you're going to give me a list of, you know, sort of marginalia. But if I were talking to you, trying to find out what Gil Noble thought about the world, you understand what I'm saying? I would have to listen to you like I listen to you.
Mm-hmm.
See, because otherwise I'd be doing this, and I would miss what your face looked like, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. What your hands were doing when you said something, you know. Yeah. And that's all, you know, the registration of perception. I mean, that's what how we breathe and stuff like that. I don't have to think about that. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Do you ever force yourself to write when you don't feel like writing?
Yeah. It's called professionalism. Right? That means you have to get and do it. Well, that's the difference between an assignment and, say, you know, amusement. You know, when the muse comes and slaps you down, Alice Walker says, sit down, I don't want to hear anything else. Pick up that pencil. Well, that's different from having to really, you know, conjure it up. Although I've never cottoned to this, or never believed in these writer's blocks. People like Hemingway and people like that always talk about he had to sharpen 20 pencils before he started writing. Well, don't write. Go downstairs. You know, I mean, read, walk around. But I don't think it's, well, it's different strokes, you know, for anybody. You know, but the discipline is that you can do it, and you know you can do it. For me, that's my discipline, the fact that I know I can do it. I had to write 4 essays for the National Black Arts Festival, and I wrote them. People said, well, it's getting late. You only got 4 days to go. But it's that thing of knowing you can do it, you know? So it's not you don't get frenzied. You know what I'm saying? Because I know if you give me 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20, I can write that. So I don't get frenzied like that, you know?
Okay. Let's take a break.
Mm-hmm.
Come back with some more.
Right. Sometimes. Yeah, most times. Really? But, you know, sometimes you just listen to it as a background. Sometimes you're really trying to pump it for something, you know.
Uh-huh.
But I always have music. I mean, you know, we're very musical, obviously. Oh, yeah. Well, my peoples is just very musical.
Peoples.
Yeah. No, we've been musical. I mean, I've never had anything in the street, in my house, in my room, but music. I mean, all the time. Because music is a language, you know. It's, I mean, people want to be told whatever the music they have is telling them. You know, it doesn't need words. You know, there's ideas in the sound. You know, that's why some music make you sad. Some music make you happy. You don't have to have words saying, be sad or be happy. It's in the sound. So sometimes I just listen to music all the time. You know, in fact, when I leave out of here, I'm going right to Tower Records and get
What do you think about where music has come and gone?
Well, it's, you see, the music reflects the social development of a particular society. When we were at our peak, say, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, that was one kind of music, you know, the kind of revolutionary music that was being made by people like Eiler and, you know, Coltrane and, you know, then the people before that, you know, Max and, you know. But then as the whole social context gets more reactionary and backward, then you'll see that the ideas reflected as music become. Then suddenly you get fusion, which is con and fusion, I guess. Commerce takes over. Like when rap begins, rap doesn't begin with the foolishness that it is now. In a more progressive period, say, what, Africa Bambaataa, Curtis Blow, or Grandmaster Flash, and then or even early Public Enemy, there's a certain kind of political vibrancy and progressiveness to it, you know, even though they might still use some language people don't like. But as Warner and his brothers take over, you know what I mean, and begin to absorb our thing, you understand what I'm saying? Then suddenly we find that our own form, art form, and rap is old as the planet. You know, old is only happens probably to pygmies because the pygmies older don't even know how to play the drums. They're so old. You know what I'm saying? They're older than God. But the point is that when the society starts to change, then you see the whole reflection of it as registered in the music change until you get, well, we're at a place now where we got Kenny G, you know, who arguably could be a machine, I don't know, and a turnaround of new young musicians who are starting to get away from that kind of deadening commercialism of fusion, you know what I mean, and trying to get back to a deeper, more sensuous, you know, a more truthful, you know, reflection of life. I heard a guy the other night, Rodney Kendricks, piano player who's used to be with the Funkadelics and James Brown, who apparently came to Thelonious Monk, worked a little bit with Abby, you know, and then I heard him the other night, boy, he's terrifying. Boy, I mean, he's a beautiful young piano player who is jumped out of Monk's pocket, you know. So, and more you're seeing some of these young people now starting to step away from pure commerce. You know, the kind of where 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I mean, the music business was a mess.
But you say that the arts are an expression of what's going on in society.
Yes.
So does it therefore follow that rap, whether you like it or not, is a reflection of what's happening in society?
Absolutely. But the dialectic of that is this. It also depends on your own ideological interpretation of what's happening in society. You understand?
Sure.
Because, you know, I mean, the stroke, and we're all perceiving, but what is our rationale for what we perceive? And then based on that rationale, what is our use of that information? You understand what I mean? I mean, you could see a bomb fall on Tokyo, a bomb, and one dude would be driving and say, hey, man, ain't that beautiful? And the other person would start crying.
Yeah.
You understand? So it's a question of the rationale, you know, but certainly we must know this in this period of corporate takeover, downsizing and all that kind of stuff. We know that the corporations, no matter what you do, are going to leap on your back like the leopard man and steal it, you know. And one of the things about Afro-American music, certainly, and I think any of the let's say music of the people that does not get eliminated by commerce, is that you have to change place almost like you are, you know what I mean? You stay there long enough, you can only stay to the next night like you an Underground Railroad. Then you got to move. You got to do something else. Otherwise, they'll eat that up. You know, you see with Motown now, you listen to Motown, listen to all the ads on TV, right? I mean, some of the most beautiful music out of the 60s, Smokey Robinson, people like that, the Miracles, the Temptations. Now they're advertising soap flakes, you know what I mean, and garbage bags, you know. I mean, because that's this society's use for, quote, beauty and intelligence. You know what I mean? Exploitation.
Well, give me your analysis of where this society has come.
Where it's going to fascism. It's trying right at this very moment while we speak, while they're burning our churches down. I don't think O.J. Simpson burned down all those churches. He could have burned down a couple. I don't think he burned down all those churches, black churches. At this very moment, these people are trying to go back to fascism. They're trying to destroy the Reconstruction again. You see, like in 1863, you know, the Emancipation Proclamation. By 1876, we were like back in neo-slavery. You understand what I mean? By 1896, separate but equal. It is apartheid. Apartheid started in the United States, not South Africa. Just like fascism started in the United States, not Germany, you know.
In that broad context, where do you place our situation as a people? Have we come forward? Now, you come out of all that activism of the 60s, the Gary experience, and what happened in Newark and whatnot. Have we come forward?
Yeah, but it's like Lenin said, one step forward, two steps back. You know, we struggled for democracy along with the people of the world in the 60s and 70s. What happened is classic. We developed a whole middle class, political class, you know, who we in our naivete thought would lead our struggle to the next increment of democracy, who, you know, sold their behinds like whores. You know what I mean? And in doing that, and what's spectacular, they did the same thing in the 19th century. You know, when we say, for instance, well, we had more senators and congressmen and so forth in the 1870s than we had in the 1970s. That's true, but they were doing the same thing. You know what I'm saying? And obviously, I'm not saying all of them are doing that. But let's say if we were to, like, winnow through those who are actually working for the people, those who are not, we only have two or three congressmen. You know, I'm afraid, you know. So we've created this political class that supposedly represents us, and not just the politicians. I'm talking about the business people, the stars in the arts and things like that. You get these, or like friends that we know that recently were in 60 Minutes or recently were in Lincoln Center, who have this terrifying hatred for black people and who are the best thing to happen to monopoly capitalism, you know, since slaves. That is, they found an object that can represent their interests without being them. And that's the class that we created.
Time for another break.
Yeah. God, I wonder how I get rid of this.
Your roots. How would you, what kind of report card would you give Newark?
Well, we did the same thing first, actually. That's why I speak so authoritatively on creating this little mini pimple worth of Negroes who actually serve imperialism better than they serve us, because you just named all those things that we did, all of those. We built a thriving black middle class in Newark. You know, we got wall-to-wall Negroes, the mayor, the councilman, the Board of Education, all that stuff. And what they did effectively is just give the power back into the hands of the state. I mean, for instance, the guy who was the superintendent of schools, when he was the superintendent of schools, I must say I was as close to him as anybody on the planet. You understand? I mean, until he got the gig, you see. And then systematically for 13 years, he would not do anything but what the powers that be indicated. See, so then when the powers that be had whatever their tactical line of colored slaughter, when that was carried out, then they came and said, well, this is wrong. The schools are messed up. Hey, man, we were going to, in the 50s down, they tell them the schools were messed up. But the point is that when that little narrow middle class, that little, my mayor, my police chief who just got busted, mm-hmm. you know what I mean, who I told Sharp not to hire in the first place because he was involved with that Broxbury stuff. When these people get in these positions, they do not do for us. You understand? Like even Jesse, my man, and I have a book coming out on Jesse in September called Jesse Jackson and Black People, or Black People and Jesse Jackson. I forgot which. But it's the same thing. And I was arguing with him in 88 with that Dukakis stuff. Black people don't want you here so you can come down here and do what these people say. See, they sent you down here as the head of their thing, you know, as the president of Afro-America, if you will, to do what we need. Even if somebody beat you up or knock you down or shoot you, we don't want to see you doing the knee dance. You understand? Like the Dukakis thing. Oh, I could have sent, I forgot, you know, I didn't send you a notification. And my little son, he was a little boy there, because I took him all down. He said he could have called the Secret Service. They knew where he was. So a little baby could see through that, you know. But the point is, they do not serve. They, and that's because they want to get in this, get in America. And I'm not, we've never been citizens. This has never been a democracy in reality, from my steep analysis. I mean, from Equiano to David Walker to, you know, Fred Douglas to Harriet Tubman to Du Bois, they say the same thing, you know. So I'm just repeating them. But the point is, Jesse Jackson, you cannot come up there and then succumb to these people. I mean, the fact, the integrity that the black middle class is missing, you understand, the consistency, you know, means that the only way finally we will succeed is with a leadership composed in the main of black working class people. I'm talking about black people. Because the whole of this country is going to have to go through some kind of revolutionary process.
You mentioned, you referred to powers that be. Are you saying that the same powers that existed in the 50s and 60s of which controlled city government exist now and have that sway over the elected officials?
The elected officials are like, remember Pee Wee Marquette used to open the door for Birdland? Well, I said, how you doing, boy? That's who the elected officials are. They have no more. And why? And why can they remove them so easily? Because the minute they get completely assured that they end, that they're part of the great fabric, you know, of American governance, boom, then they chop their heads off. See? Because then they realize they are not connected to their real source of power anymore. That they alienated themselves from their real source of power, so they can kill them. Well,
what about leadership, non-political leadership? How would you rate them as opposed to 30 years ago?
Well, I think we're just trying to merge now, certainly in the arts. And I have to accept some responsibility for where we are in that. My thrust now is to begin to talk about, not begin, but to put out a lot of literature talking about the need for self-organization, self-reliance, Du Bois' self-consciousness and self-defense, that we have to create and use our revolutionary art to create a revolutionary culture, that is, a doing that is aggressively thrust against what's, you know, oppressing us. You understand? I'll give you an example. What's his name? Jackson. Michael Jackson sold 93 million copies of the album. Michael Jordan he's the prince of the air. I mean, Mike Tyson is the emperor of knockout people. Well, anything you want to say about the arts, we are the masters of that. We were artists when we was the only people on the planet. You understand what I'm saying? So why are we so poor? You understand? Because we have not developed the consciousness that Du Bois called for, the self-consciousness to understand that you don't have to give your stuff away. It's your stuff. What you have to do is organize it. For instance, I'm saying 200 writers. We can publish our own books, publish a magazine, you know, develop a network of distribution just by putting money into it regularly, a co-op, a commune. We would have whatever audience we would have immediately would be those who are in that commune, that collective, you see. But it's the self-consciousness. It's being able to perceive something and then develop a rationale that serves your interests.
On that note, another pause. The arts. Why did you come down so hard on Spike Lee's movie on Malcolm X?
Well, you see, it doesn't, you know, people never see the whole world. The world, like Marx said, is half seen, half unseen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I had purposely not said anything about Spike Lee in the beginning. You know, people said, well, he's too young, so forth and so forth, you know. I didn't say anything about him. I just laid back. You know, I didn't like the stuff that he did, but I wouldn't say it publicly. Then He calls me up and wants to, you know, hey, Mamu, I want you to write this on, what is that, the thing, the worst movie in the world, what's it called? More Better Blues. Do we need a More Better Blues, first of all? But anyway, he calls me and he wants to, I said, well, hey, man, you don't really want me to write anything on your stuff, you know what I mean? Just take it from me, just be cool. No, I want you to write something, man. He says, I'll give you $3,500. I said, okay, I'll do it. So he says, so I wrote, and I wrote on every movie ever made, and I put them all down. Why? Because I didn't like him. I didn't have anything against Spike. I didn't like his son. And what I said about Malcolm X was this. that the film on Malcolm will be just like the other six or seven films he's made. First of all, it will like be a caricature. Like all black people in his movies are a caricature. They funny, ha-ha, or funny, peculiar. Like Do the Right Thing. He's got Robert Mitchum walking around there with a radio pretending to be a rapper. You know, it was the guy, brother, what was the name, who started the rebellion. He had love on one hand and hate on the other hand, mm-hmm. tattoo. That's Robert Mitchum in Night of the Hunter. A Night of the, you understand what I'm saying?
Night of the Hunter.
Yeah, that's the same thing. He's got the little Negro on his knees picking up the money that the guy gave him. He thinks that the black liberation movement is about putting photos in a pizza parlor. You mean you're going to demean Malcolm X and Martin Luther King to that? You're going to say that black people struggle about putting photos in a pizza parlor? Maybe it's that for you since you're getting paid by the pizza parlor. You understand? It don't make no sense. He's got the even the black political prototypes. He's got Ozzy walking around a drunk. You know, so I said, here's what he's going to do. He's going to first caricature Malcolm X. He's going to focus mostly on that Malcolm X that we know as the pimp and the drug dealer, because Hollywood goes for that. That's what they do. When they do black people, that's what comes in their mind, you know? Comic. Like, did you dig them zoot suits that he had on those people? That's a caricature, man. I mean, I'm not going to call you age, but I know you know what a zoot suit looked like and the brothers who wore zoot suits.
Well, I read about it.
Oh, you read about it. Okay. But you know it wasn't that. It wasn't a caricature.
Yeah.
You understand? It could be a caricature if you want to make fun of Cab Calloway. See, but even Cab Calloway's stuff wasn't corny. It was exaggerated, but it wasn't corny. That stuff that Denzel and what's the name of it, that was corny. That's like what you call corny. You know, that's like some suburban a racist coming to make fun of you. You know what I mean? Brown's in. What I got to do with that? You know, I'm telling you about the perception. You know, the ideas burn you up. So I said, that's what he's going to. And then I said, when he comes to the really political part, he's going to flub that because he has no interest in the politics. What about somebody who wants to put down Malcolm X and Martin Luther King at the same time? Why? You mean you don't have a preference? You mean you don't have to dig Malcolm. You don't have to dig Martin. No, who is our leader? You understand what I mean? Why would you call Martin Luther King womanizer and then make Malcolm marginal in our consciousness that the only thing we can say he did is found out that white people were the devil? I mean, that was his great accomplishment. Oh, you know what? They ain't the devil. So in other words, you want to make him exactly like Martin Luther King, but slower. You understand? And then that last scene where he's smiling as he gets killed, like the willing hostage to the day. I couldn't, you know, and that's what you got, a bunch of little stupid Negroes that go to these little schools. You know what I mean? They get the capacity to make these films, and they think all they have to do is say, well, niggas have never done nothing. They never know nothing. I am the first Negro to know anything, and I'm going to start what? So then so only black people can't make a revolution until this middle-class Negro picks up something from the ground, a garbage cup, and throws it through the window, and then he don't even know why he did that. Is that the extent of our commitment to revolutionary transformation? You see what I mean? So then if you want to try to cap me and say, well, Baraka, you don't know. Well, come on, struggle. Let's go. You want to talk about it? You want to argue about it? You want to compare your understanding of it? And so then I read a book where he got this guy who called Malcolm Benedict Arnold. What was his name? He was who I know. You know, he was the security chief at Temple Number 7. You know, that guy who hated Malcolm, who I always suspected of being closer to that rub out than. And so this guy says that Baraka was up in the temple and Malcolm asked him to get out. I said, well, this is bizarre, man. So, I had a lawyer look into that. The guy, before we could even go look into it, my man is dead. You know, this, what's his name? The guy who was the security at Temple Number 7, I think it was his name.
Probably best that we don't remember.
Right,
don't
okay. Let's say the dead person.
The dead person. And on that note, we'll take another break. We'll be right back right after this. Ever approach you to talk about this?
He called me up one night and said, I want to discuss this with you, but don't bring nobody with you, like I'm a hoodlum or something. So I said, hey, later.
You didn't go?
No, I mean, he wasn't. So then he changed his mind. I wasn't interested in really talking to him like that. I was interested in having a dialogue so that he wouldn't mess up the film. The only thing I didn't want to do is mess up that film. See, I didn't want to see happen what happened. I spent half the film on the dance. You spent a whole what millions of dollars on that dance. And finally, you know, I know the kind of impotence of what I'm saying to the extent that then why don't you do your own movie? Exactly. See, that's what I said. All of these black people, Latinos, anybody, working class white people who are in struggle against this thing. Finally, we have to stop being unwilling, unconscious prostitutes, and we have to network our own thing. We have to do your own thing. You cannot walk around complaining because the New York Times will not praise your book, saying the New York Times should be burned to the ground. That's a little bizarre. You know, you have to be able to create. Where's your New York Times? Or your New York space? You understand what I'm saying?
What about artistic freedom?
Yeah. Well, you can't have any artistic freedom if you don't have a venue to perform. If you have no journals, you have no... Look, I had two books out last year. The Times didn't review those. The New York Times would not print W.B. Du Bois' name for 17 years. I'm not talking about review his books. I'm talking about mention his name. Now, I know they might really think, you know, that... what is his name? Whoever, I can't even think of it. They might really think a number of people are more... They might really think that Norman Mailer is more, you know, intelligent than W.E. Du Bois. They might. You know, I give them the benefit of the doubt. They might believe that. You see what I mean? Is that the reason that you don't print his name and you print the other one's name? It's ideological, isn't it?
I want to talk to you about the relationship between the genders among our people. We saw the march, the Million Man March, and we've seen a number of critiques about that march because it excluded women.
I thought that was the correct criticism of it. Yeah.
What do you say? What is your read on the relationship between the genders?
I don't think the march helped it, finally, because I think that, you know, see what's sharp now. It should be understood. Is that we're in a backward period, you know, and what passes for feminism usually is another form of nationalism that really, you know, splits men and women for whatever reason. But Martin Luther King never created any marches that wouldn't let women in, or you know, Martin Luther King never talked for like, you know, 45 minutes about, you know, Masonic symbolism. You know what I mean? I'm saying that the whole movement has gone backwards. And just like white America, which is, an abstraction, a myth, but it still, it thinks it exists. Just as white America is being led by the right-wing Christians, who have never been Christians, you know what I mean? So that black America is being led by conservative Muslims, you see? And it's very, very, you know, it's tuning in, you know? Now, as a communist, and if that's my problem, I'm black and red, and blue a lot of times. You know. I would be in a united front with the Nation of Islam. I would be. I would be in a united front with them. You see what I mean? But it would be a relationship based on unity and struggle. You see? You understand what I mean? To the extent that they are opposed to imperialism, we comrades, we going down with that. You see, but to the extent that you want to be a nationalist, or you deal in metaphysics, or you deal in an anti-democratic thrust like telling the sisters they can't come, would you have told that to Tubman? You understand? I mean, am I to understand that the sisters there are saying, yes, we do not have to go? Because to assert simply that our women's diminution somehow results in our enlargement is, you know, curious.
Aside from the march, what is your read, though, on the relationship between the genders here? Is it good?
Well, I think, first of all, it has to be worse than it was 20 years ago, because the whole coherence of the Afro-American family has been weakened. See, when people talk about the family's weak or the relationship between the genders weak, it's because the whole forward, progressive, revolutionary thrust has been diminished. Even in the 60s, when, you know, you don't know whether you're going to get shot from this day to that day. People busting your house. You're getting your head split open, your teeth knocked out by these piggy wiggies out here. Still, you have to remember that the family was stronger. People were making more money. Some of the absurd things you see in the ghetto, you understand, where Newark ghetto where we live, some of the absurd things, I mean, the murders, the kind of corruption, the deep drug kind of pall over our community. You didn't see that in the 60s, you see? You saw a lot of wild things, but the fact that so many of the young people were actually, had been moved. You know, when you looked at the Panthers or looked at our organization, the Congress of African People, or the Young Lords, Felipe and them, you know, some of the same people, same kind of people, same age people, you know, who were out there struggling with them, with these police, are now some of the same people running in places, holding them out, but selling drugs, you know? So the, when the kind of ideological catalyst for transformation is diminished or removed, then the gender thing is going to get worse. The family thing is going to get loose. And the problem also with the gender thing is this, that the women's movement has been taken over by white middle-class women. So when they start talking about abortion is what's happening, most third world sisters who are triply oppressed, black women and working class women, you know, colored women who are triply oppressed, you know, gender and nationality, you know, as well as class. When you got a movement run by white middle-class women who only want to push abortion so they can get a gig, most of the black women and women, with that, that's genocide. When they sterilize 25% of the women in Puerto Rico, you know what I mean? They're not going to then go for a movement like that. And so then you get this feminist thing, which is basically petty bourgeois, white women, professionals, who in the end do not care about the mass struggle of working people of all nationalities, nor of the oppressed nationalities.
Okay, time for another break. We'll be back. Young people.
Mm-hmm. Well, they are the only hope we got, you know, that...
You like what you see today out on the street?
Well, let me say this. There's more progressive stuff out there than the media. The media says we bad, bad, bad. See, we're not that bad. You understand what I'm saying? For instance, the kids who are actually in doing all the actual overtly backward stuff are a minority. And even though they got most of our kids, they're trying to lock them up, these unproductive schools. Look, if you begin to look, you see a lot of youth now beginning to look at this thing and trying to find a way out of it. You know, so I don't think by any means a whole generation is lost. That's what they say. That's bizarre. It's not so simple. And, you know, I got a bunch of kids. And I'm proud of most of them. You know, they're doing it. You know, they're doing it. And they're trying to they're trying to understand the society. You understand? And the fact is they have no schools. I mean, you send your child to a public school, it's like dropping them in a garbage can. Although that's where mine went. You know, because we were struggling at the time to actually try to control those schools. And we were silly enough to see somebody who looked like us and figured they could do it based on the skin, but the skin is not up in there popping. You see, that's about ideology, not nationality.
Coming back to where we began, this is our last segment. Where do you then see the role of the artist? Can the artist lead progressive change, or does the artist simply reflect whatever is going on?
The artist has to be part of the kind of revolutionary forces to help transform society. Now, the leadership thing is a moot question. The question is to be part of that leading force. You understand? Now, that's what I said before about that Million Man March and at Tony K. Bambara's funeral. I said, well, we artists calling ourselves revolutionary, when are we going to insert? When are we going to intervene into the political affairs of our people and America at large? You mean you're going to sit back being hip while the world is destroyed? See, that's what they want to do. They say, well, that, you know, Bill Clinton is corny and Dole is corny. Well, if he's corny, he's running your life. What does that make you? You know what I'm saying? So the point is that if you claim some kind of revolutionary vision, you know, are you some revolutionary art worker, you're some kind of revolutionary culture worker, then you have to use that as a weapon and as a direction of struggle. You see, right now I'm trying to see that we can develop these national publishing houses and networks for sending theater around. We have a treasure chest. You know, I look at BET, for instance. My man Bob Johnson said, "Does he know anything about the music?" You look at that. You know, you send these people letters. You say, "What is wrong with you? You got a treasure chest. All of these fine actors we have. Have they not never heard of Fred Douglas? You know, don't they know who Du Bois is? Don't they know that Langston has hundreds of books with short stories, novels, his autobiography? You understand what I mean? Why don't we go into the treasure chest? That's what the artist is supposed to be doing. Taking the experience of the people, like Cabral says, the people is the repository of resistance. Why? Because their culture insists that they not be absorbed by imperialism. Why? Them people be walking down the street like this? Are they thinking their arms and legs are thinking, don't be absorbed, don't be absorbed? No, they it's in there. Like they say about that tomato sauce. You know what I'm saying? It's all in there. And that's resistance. Why don't you talk like this? I don't know. Why don't you walk like this? I don't know.
Can we move forward without this drug thing being dealt with?
Well, no, we cannot move forward unless we have the self-determining leadership to create a kind of vehicle. First, I think a newspaper. We need some national kind of communication, you know. Then we need a revolutionary party. You know, I'm a communist, so I'm saying a party that's going to talk about building communism or making a revolution. But then we need, for all the different nationalities, we need a united front and a political electoral party. We need a united front of all the people, the black people, the white people, the Chicano people, the Puerto Rican people, you understand, the Jamaican people, all the people together against imperialism. We need a party that will first seek to struggle for democracy. Because there's never been no democracy in this country. You see, for instance, you got a Senate. You don't need no Senate. The Senate comes from England. It doesn't do nothing. You spend your money. What you need is a real Congress. You know, you need one person, one vote is what we need. You know what I'm saying? But you don't need, how can it be two senators in Utah and two in New York? Don't nobody live in Utah. Except Nazis. But you know what I'm saying.
I know what you're saying. I really appreciate you spending time with us.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And thanks for being with us in still another edition of Like It Is. Good afternoon.